thought it would be helpful, since we keep mentioning Acts 20, 28 to 32 over and over again in the class, I just thought it might be helpful for you to have a discussion of that whole section. So if you wanted to read over that, that might give you some more background, because throughout the rest of the quarter, we'll be regularly going back to Acts 20, and we'll say, as Paul said in Acts 20, 28, elders are to take heed unto themselves and to the flock over the which the Holy Ghost hath made them overseers, to shepherd the flock of God, and so forth. Okay. Any questions or comments about that? Well, I hope everybody's doing real good. I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight, because now we're really getting into the mentality of elders and how an elder thinks. And it's a very beneficial study, I think. I wanted to bring up a couple of passages at the beginning that are critical passages about elders' authority. And I bring them up because we have talked about some of the main passages in the New Testament about the eldership. But somehow or another, in our discussion so far, we did not so much get to these two passages. But they are very important in terms of showing us how elders exercise authority. The first is 1 Timothy 5:17, and this passage will come up again, but I just wanted to bring it out by itself and focus in on it for a minute. It says, "Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching." There it says, and I've highlighted it, although it's kind of hard to see, I've highlighted the word rule. And that's really what the word means, is that elders have this authority. Some people have said elders only have the authority of influence. But we will see that that's not true. We're going to have a whole class on the authority of the eldership later on in the quarter. But this passage is enough to show you that the elder's authority goes beyond just the mere setting of a good example. Really, all Christians have the authority of setting a good example, don't they? Are you not responsible for setting a good example for me, and I'm responsible for setting a good example for you? And if that's all that the elders have, then they don't have anything that's different beyond all the other members. But here, we're reading about a group of people who rule over the church, and that's what the elders have. Now, their rule is a certain kind of rule. It's not a harsh dictatorship, is it? Because in 1 Peter 5, we read that they are not lording it over the flock. Their attitude is not just trying to make a show of power or something like that, but they're shepherds. Now, shepherds, when we think about shepherds leading sheep around, they're in charge of those sheep, aren't they? And they're in charge of making sure those sheep stay safe insofar as they're capable. And so it's a shepherding kind of authority, but in matters of judgment, elders have authority. They don't have matters of authority. They don't have authority where Christ has spoken on something, do they? Nobody does, because Christ is the head of the church. Ephesians 5:24 and following. Christ is the head of the church. And so Christ gets to set the agenda. But in carrying out that agenda, the elders exercise judgment as to how to do it, how to be most effective in carrying it out. Okay? Questions about this verse before I show you another one? We'll come back to it again as we go on. But now here's another important verse. Paul says, "We ask you, brothers, to respect those who labor among you and are," here's your phrase, this is how we know he's talking about elders, "who are over you in the Lord, and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Be at peace among yourselves." That word that's translated "are over you," the "over you" word, is the same word that you find in this verse we just looked at, 1 Timothy 5:17, that says rule. So we're emphasizing that they have the authority. So in 1 Timothy 5:17, it's translated rule. In 1 Thessalonians 5:12, it's translated over you. And notice our attitude toward them is to be respectful. We're respecting those who have the rule over us. Do all members of the church always achieve that level of proper attitude toward the elders? Sometimes they don't, and that's a very sad thing. Elders have to deal with some members who don't follow this verse. That's right. Okay, ready for our quiz? It's quiz time. Did you remember every single thing from last week? No failure on that part. I'm sure I can't remember everything, but let's see what we can do. Question number one. Last week we said that a bishop must be the blank of one blank. Think about it for just a minute. He must be the husband of one wife. Very good. See, you're on the right track. You're doing good. Here we are. Number two, the word translated blank in English, so I'm asking for an English word here. The word translated blank in English means cannot be taken hold of. Think for a minute. It's translated blameless. Okay, very good. That was one of the two qualifications we looked at last week. A bishop has to be blameless. You shouldn't appoint someone unless he's blameless. Number three, true or false? The Apostle Paul was qualified to be an elder. Think through it. Think through it carefully. And the answer is false. At least, why not? He wasn't married. He wasn't the husband of one wife. I guess it's possible he could have been disqualified in another way, but that's the one. Well, rules well his own house is one of the implications of husband of one wife. So there are at least two qualifications there where he's not. And of course, verse 9, says that he's got to have believing children. And so Paul clearly wouldn't fit that. But it all stems from the fact that he wasn't the husband of one wife. Okay, good. Next, true or false? Peter was an elder. And the answer is? Oh, that's true. That's true. Very good. Let's do it again. Was Peter an elder? True. Yes, he was. 1 Peter 5:1. He says that he exhorted those elders and he said, I who am also an elder. 1 Peter 5:1. Okay, good. True or false? Being married is no holier than being single. And the answer is true. That's right. Being single, it doesn't mean you're more righteous than being married, and being married doesn't mean you're any more righteous than being single. A person can be in a perfectly good relationship with God, whether he's married or not. A number of passages bear that out, but I think the fundamental one to show that single people can be right with God is any of the passages that show that Jesus wasn't married. But then, of course, also Peter was an elder in the church and an apostle. And we know from Mark chapter 2, when Jesus healed his mother-in-law, as we studied about Sunday in our class, that Peter was married. And obviously he couldn't have been an elder if he wasn't married. So it's no different in terms of your relationship with God. Although there are advantages, of course, to being married, and there are advantages to being single. More to being married than to being single. Otherwise, God wouldn't have seen the need, I suppose, to make marriage. He would have just said, everybody's perfectly all right being single, or he would have made a way for the human race to be propagated without marriage, but marriage has more advantages. Okay, ready? Number six, it is theoretically possible that a remarried man could be an elder. Now, notice how I phrased this question. I said it's theoretically possible. I'm not saying that everybody who's remarried is qualified to be an elder in their second marriage, but true or false, is it theoretically possible? It's true. That's right. A remarried man could, under the right circumstances, if everything worked out right, he could be an elder. And now, that's all the quiz, so I hope you got them real good. 100%? I saw one or two, I think, got 100%. That's good. Maybe more of you. Now, here's our qualifications for tonight. We're talking about he's got to be sober-minded and self-controlled in the ESV. In the King James Version, it says, this is 1 Timothy 3:2, he's got to be vigilant and sober. And in the American Standard Version, it's he's got to be temperate and sober. So let's take the first one of those first. And these two are somewhat similar in their meaning. They are trying to argue, Paul is trying to argue, that an elder must be a very clear-thinking person. An elder has to be someone who has practical wisdom. That is, in my view of things, practical wisdom means that you are able to, with reasonable accuracy, predict how things will turn out when you make a decision. You can look, it doesn't mean you have perfect view of the future. Only God has that. But you have a sense of the weight of various aspects of a decision, various factors that go into making a decision. And you are able to say, if you have this kind of vigilant, sober, temperate view of things, you are able to say, let me weigh this and then see how things are going to turn out and seriously treat that decision. These two qualifications are really where the rubber meets the road in terms of decision making. That elders recognize the weight of certain aspects of decisions and give those things proper weight, and that they are not flippant about decisions, that's included here, and that they can see what how things will turn out. If we do this, here's what may result from this. And is that the way we want to go, or do we want to go this way? And I've been in elders' meetings here, and I think our elders would be happy for me to say this, where they will very often say to one another, and this is their practical wisdom showing through, they'll say to one another, now, wait a minute, if we do that, this might happen. And we got to be prepared for this eventuality if we make this decision. Or here are the consequences to this. And then they have to weigh all those possible consequences within the strictures of what the Bible says. You don't weigh consequences independent of what the Bible says. You take the Bible principles, apply them, and say, okay, here's the options that are biblically open to us. And then we say, which one will produce the best outcome spiritually for our members? And that takes a lot of sobriety. That takes a lot of vigilance and temperance and just clear, level-headed thinking. And that's largely what these two words are talking about. Let's take them one by one. How about the first one? Vigilant in some translation, temperate in other translations. It literally means holding no wine. But every time this word is used in the New Testament, it's used in a metaphorical sense of temperate. You know, when we talk about temperance as a virtue, we don't just mean not drinking, do we? Not intoxicated. We are referring to being in control of yourself, right? And that's exactly what this word means here. It's translated to be calm, or it's interpreted by this expert to be calm, dispassionate, and circumspect. Circumspect means able to look around and see all sides of an issue, or able to look around and see all possible dangers that might be coming your way. That's circumspect, and that's implied by this word vigilant or temperate. And then it says self-controlled. Another commentator says that it means self-controlled. And it's translated sober. So the second word is usually translated sober. This word sometimes is translated sober. That's why I'm saying that these two words are very closely related. But as I said, it refers to clear thinking or practical wisdom. For example, in an English dictionary, the word vigilant means on the alert, as for danger or error, watchful. So think about a shepherd with sheep. Isn't he standing up at night watching, or sitting back in the shadows and watching for any predators that might come around? He's very careful about that. Isn't an elder in the church very watchful about things that might be dangerous to the flock and trying to protect them from those things? That's vigilant. And then here's Acts 20:28 that I think clearly expresses vigilance. And I really would prefer to translate this vigilance. I think that's a great way to translate it. It says, pay careful attention. Now, first it says, pay careful attention to yourselves. And then it says, pay careful attention to the flock over which the Holy Ghost has made you overseers. So an elder first needs to take heed or be vigilant unto himself. What does that mean? What would you think in practical terms? What does it mean? What is an elder doing if he's taking heed to himself? What do you think? If you saw an elder and you said, here's an elder who is taking heed to himself, what kind of things is he doing? Yes, ma'am. Okay, so she said that he's watching over his own character. He's trying to guard against things that might inhibit him from making the right decisions. Do you think a vigilant elder, this elder who's taking heed, that's what vigilant would imply, taking heed, is he a prayerful man? Is he praying himself? What, is he in Bible study? Is he in personal Bible study on a regular basis? This is somebody who is practicing what he preaches. When he's trying to feed the flock of God, he's making sure he is fed himself. He's making sure he's in good shape. A shepherd who's not fit to watch the sheep doesn't need to be in that position, but he's making sure that he's spiritually fit. He's making sure he's fed and he has a right relationship with God. So he's taking heed to himself first. I put up this picture of a road with a I just went online and tried to find the picture of the straightest straightaway on the road that I could find, because I really think an elder who is vigilant, who is clear thinking and circumspect, is going to be one who can keep the church on the right path. He can just guide it right straight on down the road. And so that might be a good metaphor for thinking about vigilance or sobriety. Now let's move on to this word sober, and we'll think more about practical applications of it after we get the words in our head and what they mean. It literally means saving your mind. It's a compound word. The first word means save, and the second word means your mind. So it means save your mind. And that's interesting. Obviously, we don't use that kind of phraseology. We don't talk about saving your mind. But the word then means, based on that literal meaning, it means to be of a sound mind, sane, in one's senses, or prudent. This word is used for the man after Jesus cast legion of demons out of him. And then remember, he was sitting. It said he was sitting and he was clothed, and he was what? In his right mind. And that's the word that's used here. Elders have to be in their right mind. It doesn't mean that they need to be sane as opposed to insane, but it means that they need to be real clear in their thinking about things. And it says it's translated discreet in Titus 2:5 in describing virtuous wives, that he is discreet. So here's somebody who is not flippant, and he is not being silly about things. Now, sometimes elders can laugh and have fun just as much as the next person, and I think that's an asset in an elder rather than a detriment. But as I think we said about deacons the other night, who are supposed to be sober. Remember, we had a sermon Sunday night about deacons, and one of their qualifications was they've got to be sober. And that, of course, refers not only to not being drunk with alcohol, but it refers to not having your thinking clouded by whatever thing. Somebody who is not sober in their thinking can't get that car down the road. Sober, somebody who's not sober from alcohol. They're intoxicated and they're swerving around. Somebody who's not sober in the faith is not going to be able to keep the church on the straight and narrow path. And so here's somebody who is wise and prudent and clear thinking. Question or comment about that? I think we know what it's like to be around somebody who's flippant, don't you? Have you ever been around somebody who you would just categorize as somebody who just can't get serious about serious things? Somebody who is always making a joke about something even when it's real serious? Or you just can't imagine asking them for counsel? Have you been around people where maybe they're fun to be around to watch a ball game with, but you can't really imagine seeking their counsel or their wisdom about something, because you would think they're just not the kind of person you would ever ask for counsel from? But an elder is somebody you would, because of an elder's wisdom, because of an elder's prudence, because an elder is likely to give you an answer about how to fix your problem, how to biblically fix the situation. Maybe not solve all the consequences, maybe not resolve everything, but somebody who can put you in the right direction. Very good. Now, I put this up here because it has the word peer pressure, and all around the word peer pressure, you have various things that might cause you to have trouble with peer pressure, and usually this kind of a slide is used for teenagers. But I just wanted to observe, we probably make a real big mistake when we act as though peer pressure is just a problem for teenagers. Isn't peer pressure a problem for grown-ups too? In what way is peer pressure sometimes a problem for grown-ups, for people of all ages? Okay, good. So I heard keep up with the Joneses, and I think that's exactly what you're saying, is you try to become materialistic, or you become materialistic because you're so entranced by what somebody else has. Sometimes adults do that. What's that now? That's right. Surely would. If you're always associating with people who have more than you, that's going to be an especially bigger temptation. That's right. That's good. That's an example. Sometimes peer pressure is bad on that. What else? What would you add? Mm-hmm. Okay, peer pressure to cave in on moral issues, to say, well, maybe that's not so bad. You know, so many people think it's all right now. I guess I'll just go along with it. And see, I'm bringing this up about elders because elders cannot give in to peer pressure. But sometimes you're in a group of people who are mostly your peers, or they're somewhere around being your peers in the church, and they may put pressure on you to cave in about something where you've got to stand up for the truth, and that requires sobriety. That requires clear thinking where you say, I'm sticking to what the Bible says and I'm sticking to what the elder's best judgment is, even if other people don't like it. And that's hard. It's hard to stick by your guns when there are people who don't like it, isn't it? Yes, Jeff, I think you had... Oh, dear.
Decide that we want things done this way, right. My way. So getting off influence and the pressure that you receive, those people who are your peers,
that's
all
right.
Of a sudden, they want the church to change directions. They want
that's
the church
right.
to change behaviors. They want the church to act differently, to attract more people.
That's one reason, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
It's from within your own arena right here.
That's right. Now, think about, you mentioned one of them, the concern over a greater numbers. And what church wouldn't like to have greater numbers in attendance? Everybody would. But if elders become so focused on that they compromise something else that's important, that's bad. Or on the other hand, what if elders got so hyper-focused on doctrinal issues that they neglected to feed the flock about devotional issues? You know, we could have sermons every week on this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, but that wouldn't be a balanced diet for the flock, would it? You need to know what's wrong and you need to know what's right. That's good. So if the elders are not balanced, if they're not sober about that, they might, see, this is why I use that road thing. They might go off to this way or they might go off to that way if they're easily swayed. But elders have to know what they believe and stick to it insofar as what they believe is right. Did you have something? I thought you raised your hand. What else? This pressure. Cliques can form in churches. Remember in Galatians 2, we read about Peter and the Jewish folks, and he compromised, and he wouldn't hang out with the Gentile folks at the gathering. When the Jewish folks came in, he acted like, well, I'm not really associated with these Gentile Christians. Is that not a clique forming within a congregation? And what did Paul do about that? Did he say, well, you know, every group's got cliques. No big deal. What did he do? What's that now? He opposed him to his face. That's right. And so this is a very important thing that Jeff is saying. What else? What else is a pressure where an elder's got to be real clear thinking and not allow himself to be pushed one way or the other? Well, we'll get to some more in a minute. That's good. Okay, here's a couple of verses about being vigilant and sober. Now, kind of combining these ideas. Vigilance, carrying this idea that we've got to watch out for the safety and security of the flock. Sober, reflecting this idea that we've got to be clear thinking and be serious about serious things. Now, here's a verse. Therefore, be alert. That's the English Standard Translation of it. Be alert. Is that not vigilant and sober? Be alert, remembering that for 3 years I did not cease night or day to admonish every one of you with tears. And who's Paul speaking to? He's speaking to the elders at Ephesus. And the main thing he's wanting to tell them is, be alert. And now I commend you to God and to the word of his grace, which is able to build you up, and so forth. Here's another verse. Obey your leaders and submit to them. This is the Hebrews writer, maybe Paul, maybe Luke, someone, saying, obey your leaders, the elders, and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls. Is that not vigilance? Keeping watch over your souls as those who must give an account. Now think about having to give an account for the souls of the members of the church. At the day of judgment, I'm going to give account for my soul, for my actions that I did while I was in the body, and then you're going to give account for your soul for the actions you did while your soul was in your body. Then the elders are going to come and give account for the actions they did with their souls while they were in their bodies. And then the elders are going to give account for the things that you did with your soul while you were in your body. Now that is weighty. That is tough. And there's only, of course, so much an elder can do. We can't expect an elder to be everywhere all the time. But an elder has to be able to say something for the members that are in their charge about what they did. I remember hearing a preacher talk about one of his elders, and they were at a funeral for somebody who had died in their congregation. And I think the preacher was up by the casket, and the elder came by the casket, and the preacher, and he had a quiet moment there by the casket, and the elder looked down at the body, and he said, "What am I going to say about this person?" Now, can you imagine the pressure of that? Now, again, elders aren't Superman. They can't be everywhere all the time and do miracles. But that is, this thing about giving account for the souls in the church, that is a weighty matter. And what does that require if not vigilance to watch out for those souls and also a good deal of clear thinking and sobriety? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Sure. That's right. That's true. Well, that's true. Yes. Yes. That's a very good point. She's saying ultimately Miss Doty's responsible for her soul and not Billy or Gary. That's true. However, at the same time, they're giving account for how they shepherded your soul. You know, what did they do? And that's what you concluded with. So that's very good. What did they do to try to help this soul, you know, get to heaven? Very good. What else? Okay. Now here's, I made up some things here. Things that vigilant, sober elders watch against. And you may want to add to this list. Think about what you would add to this list. But elders are watching against lethargy in their members. Aren't there a lot of members of the church who are suffering from bad case of lethargy? And in Galatians 6:9, we read, "Be not weary in well-doing." This is to all Christians, of course. Don't be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if what? Finish the verse for me. If we faint not. Are there some members of the church that may be fainting? Now, I'm not necessarily talking about Macklin Road. I'm just saying in general, elders are looking out for members of the church who are fainting or perhaps leaning that way. And that's lethargy. So what can elders do to try to guard against that? If elders are vigilant against lethargy, what can they do? One thing is they can make sure they're real involved. That's the first thing. What if elders were to go to someone and say, "Brother, you're just not involved in the work of the church anymore." And he said, "Well, I used to come to services and I came to things over down at church, but you know, you weren't there yourself." Well, that'd be bad, wouldn't it? That wouldn't be an effective appeal. The elders can't expect good participation in church activities from the members if they're not out there themselves doing it. And so here's vigilance against lethargy. What else can the elders do to try to guard against lethargy? Against people fainting so that they don't inherit eternal life. What can they do? Very good. So we have to have feeding of a nutritious diet in the form of maybe some special classes, maybe good events that help build up people. Maybe we try to make our classes as interesting to people as we can. We do everything we can to try to encourage people to do what's right. We try to appeal to them in a variety of ways. You know, sheep are different. Some sheep are attracted by this, and some sheep are attracted by that, or the diet needs to be a little bit different to appeal to the different ones, and so they say, "Let's try this. Let's try that." Good. What else? Yep. Good. Some elders operate on the boardroom basis, and all they do is think that they just sit in a boardroom and make decisions. And that's not going to do it, is it? That's not going to work with the flock. That's not going to help. They do have to make decisions, but they got to be out there working with the sheep, don't they? And they have to be encouraging them on a personal basis. They have to be having conversations with people, addressing their concerns, meeting with people, encouraging them one-on-one or in small groups. That's very good. What else? What if an elder only hung out with a few people who were his closest buddies, and he never hung out with anybody else? Now, of course, elders are going to have friends, just like everybody else. An elder is going to have people who he's closer to than others. But what if the whole congregation got this feeling, you know, the elders, they have their own little clique, and they hang out together, and they don't, or this elder, he only hangs out with a few select people. He doesn't have any time for me. Well, that would be bad, wouldn't it? Because that would discourage a member. That would push a member more toward separating from the church if he felt like the shepherds didn't even know who he was or didn't care about him or something like that. Well, I sure am thankful we have elders who attend to everybody and don't just isolate themselves with certain ones. Very good. Or show preference. That could create bitterness in a group, couldn't it? If elders just isolated themselves with a few people. Good. What else on this issue of lethargy or ignorance? What about Ephesians 5 and verse 17? It says, be understanding what the will of the Lord is. Don't be fools, but be understanding what the will of the Lord is. Can the elders help the church not to be ignorant about the Bible? What should they do? They should study themselves. They should take heed to themselves, first of all, to make sure they have a working knowledge of the Bible. We ought to be confident in general that when we talk to our elders about the Bible, they may not have studied the Bible as much as some people have. That doesn't mean they're not qualified. What it means is they have a working knowledge of it, and they study their Bibles, and if they don't have the answer to your question, they're going to try to help you get an answer to your question, and they have a general frame of reference of understanding the Bible, and they can work with you on it. You ask them a Bible question, they're going to have heard of something in the question that you're talking about, and they're going to be able to go from that to try to find you the answer. What else can they do to fight the problem of ignorance about the Bible in the church? Guarding, being vigilant about it, being proactive about solving the problem of ignorance. Now, some members are determined to stay ignorant. I'm sure, I just believe that's true. But not all of them. The ones who want to learn, the elders should be able to help them learn. Now, what can they do? Study themselves, and then what? Yes. They're apt to teach. That's right. So they're teaching. Sometimes that's public. Sometimes it's private. But they're apt to teach. That's right. So they are taking a participative role in the education of the church. That's right. What else? What about when they select teachers for the Bible classes? And sometimes they delegate this. Elders are perfectly justified in delegating that. But they are ultimately responsible for who's teaching the classes. Does an elder say, oh, just let whoever teach it? Or when the curriculum is coming up to be chosen, do the elders just say, oh, whatever, you know, just pick something. As long as it's sort of about the Bible, you can have whatever old curriculum you... Is that the attitude a vigilant elder takes? No, he's careful about it. He picks the right thing. What else? You might think of something later on. How about the issue of worldliness? 1 John 2:15 says, we're to love not the world nor the things in the world. But there are Christians many times that have gone off into some degree of worldliness. They're not living much like Christians live anymore. What's a vigilant elder's perspective of that? What can he do to try to head off that problem or try to work toward fixing that problem? What about, yes? Okay, good. So they're not worldly themselves. You can look to them as an example. And you know, 1 Peter 5:3 says they are to be an example. So elders are examples in their lifestyle. So you should be able to look to them for an exemplary lifestyle. What about counseling young parents. One of the things about elders is that they are good family men themselves, and they've got faithful children. They've demonstrated capability in child rearing, and so aren't they going to be good ones to talk to about how to keep kids in the faith and not in the world? Surely they can offer some advice and counsel about that, and parents ought to be open to that. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Because there are elders that lack that ability or desire to confront individuals, their confrontation averse.
That's right.
So there's not the willingness. It's one thing to do it by example, and you do. But then when it comes to expressing to an individual your own wrong path.
Right. Yeah.
It's actually confronting the individual. So part of being vigilant against all of these is the willingness to go to that individual and tell them where they're erring.
That's right. Absolutely. That's absolutely true. In addition to that, I would add, what about telling the preacher to preach on moral issues? I think there are some preachers where kids grow up and they never hear a sermon about dancing. They never hear a sermon about drinking. They never hear a sermon about fornication. We don't want every sermon to be about those things. They may never heard a sermon about homosexuality. So they get out in the world, and what's the problem? The problem is the preacher didn't do it, but also it's the elders should have been saying, wait, we need a sermon on this. We need a sermon on that. I'm thankful that our elders here will say sometimes, why don't you preach about this? And I say, great, let's do it. And so we make sure we try to hit those topics. Very good. What else? False teaching. We've said something about that already. I've got some more things I want to get to. Why vigilant and sober? I think we have more like 6 minutes left. The bell, I think, was a tad early. The eldership is a working shepherding group, not just a board of directors. We said that. So they got to be vigilant and sober because, remember, it says in 1 Timothy 3:1, it says if they desire the office of a bishop, they desire a good what? A good work. Not a good sit around and make some decisions, but a good work. Not that decision-making isn't work, but it's beyond just making decisions. Okay, the eldership will give an account. We said that. Shepherds must guard the flock from danger, so vigilant and sober. Now, notice some of these things. An elder is involved in emotional circumstances. Very often when elders are making decisions about things, especially about family issues, and that's very often things that happen. It involves what's going on between a husband and a wife, a mother and a son, a father and a daughter, the conflicts within family, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, problems in families. Don't emotions run high? And what you need is somebody who's level-headed and clear-thinking. And I suggest that's one reason why we're talking about elders. We're talking about older men. We're not talking about young men who might be more likely to be swayed by somebody who's yelling at them. Do elders ever get yelled at? They do. I hope not here, but very often elders get yelled at. I remember talking to my dad about, he would talk about the fit that somebody pitched in the elders meeting, and the elders just sit there and take it, you know. If the elders are right about it, they just sit there and listen for a while, and then when he or she gets done with the fit, they say, all right, are we ready to move on and follow through with our plan? And then they do. But they have to take it. It's very disrespectful, and the person is sinning in the process and moving toward hell when they disrespect the elders that way, but the elders have to take it. But that doesn't mean they change their mind, even in emotional circumstances. How about an elder must make multifaceted decisions? There are lots of factors that play into decisions. And that's why sometimes it is so ridiculous for members to criticize elders based on about that much information. You know, the member who criticizes the elder knows about a tenth of the information that the elder was taking into account when he made the decision. And then the member gets all bent out of shape, just doesn't know. He doesn't know. It took so much discretion and so much clear thinking, so much prudence, knowing how a thing is going to turn out if we go this way or that way. How about an elder must provide a balanced diet to the congregation? We said that. An elder has personal friends and family members. Has there ever been an elder who let his wife make the decisions for him? I've heard of an elder who would excuse himself from the elders' meeting to go talk to his wife about whatever it was. That wasn't here, of course. But he'd come back in and say, well, I've rethought this issue. And then he might change. Or he votes with the elders on this issue. And elders do vote. That's very often how a decision is made, unless it's obvious that it's unanimous. Very, very often elders will vote and they'll come out with a unified decision about it. Even if there was some disagreement, they agree as a group. We'll talk about that later. But an elder might vote one way, and then the next day after he's talked with his brother, or after he's talked to his wife, or after he's talked to somebody he's close to, comes back and says, you know, I've changed my mind on that. Well, he's here in this case. What's happened is he's letting somebody with an agenda get in the way. Yes, ma'am. Oh, absolutely, yes. And I don't mean to be too far on one side of that, but that's absolutely right, yes. Elders are concerned about the needs of their sheep, and if there's a sheep that's just honestly saying, I need some help here, help me understand what's going on here, and let me try to resolve this issue in my mind, and to the best that an elder can without disclosing something he shouldn't, without betraying a trust or something, he should help that person understand. That's right. Good comment. What else? Okay, an elder will often be tired. Isn't it tempting for us to do irrational things or things that are not for the best when we're tired? I've very often thought to myself, I need to not make any decisions, any major decisions right now because I'm exhausted. And do you think elders sometimes get real tired with what they're having to go up against? I suppose so, right? And then an elder will be tempted to be overly cautious. Sometimes the easiest short-term decision is to just not do anything, even if something needs to be done. Have you ever wanted to just not do anything because it wouldn't rock the boat? But there might be an occasion when something really needs doing, even if the elders are going to have to endure some kind of backlash, or even if there's going to be some disappointment with their decision, it needs doing. And an elder who is overly cautious, who is not sober-minded enough to say, I've got to do this. An elder who's overly cautious may just not do anything and then let a situation fester for a long time, and then the fact of his inaction or their inaction might lead to a disastrous result down the road. And so it will be tempting for someone to be overly cautious. And it takes clear thinking to say, okay, here we go. How about with a church discipline case? Oh, it's a lot easier to just say, well, we'll sweep it under the rug, not worry about it. But if something needs to be done, it needs to be done. Okay, what else? I'm thinking of some ways that we can help our children, our sons especially, be wise, be vigilant and sober. And I thought of a few ways. I read something that my dad wrote on this issue, and he came up with some suggestions, and I thought this would be a good starter. Spend time with our sons, teaching them how to think as a Christian. And I'm thinking about what David said to Solomon before David died about encouraging Solomon to stay close to the Lord. The last thing, essentially, that David said to Solomon was, be faithful to God. And we must spend time with him. I'm really thinking that there are many preachers and elders who don't spend time with their sons. There are many Christian fathers who just don't spend time with their sons. And then the sons don't grow up to be elders, but they've never been inspired to be elders because dad never spent time with them encouraging them to do that. And I put some more things here. Help them befriend and observe wise men. That is, fathers and mothers have a lot to do with who a child's heroes are. And the heroes, in some sense, maybe sports stars or music stars or something, but for the most part, the real heroes need to be people who are of faith and people who are leaders in the church, elders and preachers and deacons and Bible class teachers in the church. Help them listen to every sermon and Bible class in learning mode. That is, to learn to be doers of the word, learn how to apply the word. Parents need to make sure that their children are not at... Now, children, when they first start out, aren't capable of applying everything in a sermon and hearing everything that's said. But as they grow, parents have a lot to do with how children hear. Luke 8:18 says, take heed how you hear. And if parents will say, here's how you take notes on a sermon, here's how you turn to the passages, here's how you really listen up for what's being said, that'll make a big difference in the long run in the area of wisdom. And then pray for wisdom in their presence. I heard my parents pray for wisdom for themselves so many times, and I heard them pray for me so many times, and I know that my mother still prays for me every day. And that's a powerful thing, to think about your mother praying for you. And so here are many ways in which parents can encourage their children to be wise. Fathers, I'll say this and then I'll let us go. Fathers need to make sure that their children think through situations. When a father is presented with an ethical dilemma, he should always bring it up. If it's something his kids can understand, he should bring it up and say, here's my problem. What do you think I ought to do? And then work through what the Bible says that might be relative to that issue. And that's a great exercise. I'm glad my dad did it with me. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time.